Father Austin Fleming is being interviewed by Renee Garrelick for Congress Oral History Program. The interview is taking place on February 14, 2005. Father Fleming is 57 years old. The interview is taking place at the Parish Hall on Church Street, next to Our Lady Help of Christians Church, which closed October 25th, 2004. Father Fleming, I want to tell you how happy the town has been that you have been able to continue as pastor now of the Holy Family Parish in what had been otherwise an extremely difficult year. It was actually 4 years ago that we met in February to do the project on the faith community. But 3 years ago, something that occurred that had really impacted the church considerably. And I wonder if you can address the litigation, the sex abuse, the clergy scandal, and how you and your parishioners coped with that.
It was in January, 3 years ago, that the Boston Globe broke the stories. Priests of the Archdiocese who had been a parish worker, who had been accused of sexual misconduct with minors. And not only was that sad enough news, but almost worse than that was the news that the diocese had continued to reassign priests to other parishes and realizing that they were putting children in harm's way by doing so. So that it all kind of exploded on the scene at once. And although people find this difficult to believe, those stories were really a surprise to just about everybody, certainly to myself. I think people have thought that this was going on, and certainly priests must have known about it. But indeed, I think most priests didn't know about it. I knew over the years, I've been a priest for almost 32 years now. I knew that over the years, here and there, a priest had been dismissed from ministry for sexual misconduct. But as far as I knew of, were few for these things. So it really was a surprise to people, but all of us by surprise. My approach in the parish was to be as open as I possibly knew how to be about what was going on. And keep in mind that my information was coming from the Boston Globe too. That's another thing that people think that I get daily messenger service in the archdiocese, all kinds of secret information, but it simply doesn't work that way. So my information is coming from the Globe as well as everybody else's. Over the years, I have had the occasion to serve in a counseling capacity for five different individuals, four women and one man, who were abused sexually as children, three of them by priests and two by family members. So that gave me a unique kind of perspective. I had dealt with people who were victims of sexual abuse by priests. And I'm so grateful for the opportunity to help those people because I think maybe more important than that is the vocabulary that we speak about it. That we know the problems people who didn't know how to talk about this. Even some people who wanted to talk about this weren't exactly sure what the vocabulary of this kind of experience is. So for, I think it was 3 weeks in a row, certainly 2 weeks in a row, at Mass on Sunday, rather than preach a homily or sermon, and we can learn that this opened up the floor for questions. Ask whatever you want, and I will give you the most honest answer that I have. And I'm really glad I did that, because I think that signaled to the people in the community, our ladies community, that we're not hiding this fear, and we're going to make every effort to get this as fully as possible. We had several listening sessions, evening opportunities for folks to simply gather and talk. Huge circle of chairs in the parish hall and a microphone. And anybody was free to get up and say or ask anything they wanted to about what was going on. And we had adult psychiatrists there, both to offer some professional input on the issues that were on the table, and also to know what to do this kind of work. We deal with these kinds of topics. You never know who in the group comes. There's also a difference of some form of abuse. May never have shared that with anybody before, and now because they're hearing this, they want to talk to someone. I read a weekly letter in the bulletin, and I wrote about it extensively. I wrote with a kind of advocacy point of view. Many people, including myself, were highly critical. Not only the way the Archdiocese had handled it over the years, that is to say, pretty much hiding it, questioning the whole process, moving the signs around, but also critical of the way they were handling it post the revelation. It just seemed everything was so slowly that there seemed to be little acknowledgement of the reality. Many Catholic people blame the globe for it, you know, and I would say over and over again, the globe is reporting the facts, and you might not like the facts, but don't shoot the messenger. And if the church has something to refute these stories, then let the church come forward and say, that's not true. But as you can see, they're neither taking responsibility for what's being reported, nor are they trying to do it. And their silence tells me that.
Ultimately, you were one of the signers of a letter for Cardinal Bernadore to resign. Could you comment?
Sure. I was one of the founding members of a group called the Boston Priests Forum, which actually started to organize in the summer before the January of the Revelation Institute. And it began in its first meeting in, it was November, that January. The Priest Forum was an effort by priests, a grassroots effort to organize some fellowship among priests, to gather us together, plan for bringing in guest speakers on different topics. But that had nothing to do with abuse because the story hadn't broken yet, so it was not for that purpose. But just as we were getting organized, the story did break, so that sort of was on the plate if you were beginning your organization. smaller group within the forum who wrote the letter, drafted the letter. I wasn't one of the actual drafters, but I was part of the group that got the time to write and to make a public statement about the priest's understanding of this issue. And the form of our statement of the letter to Cardinal Law, asking him to resign from the Archbishop's office because we thought that had lost the potential for continuing leadership. There was no confidence left in the position. So it was shortly after that he did resign. I personally am not convinced that some people are, that our letter was the last straw. I know something about how things work in the church. Don't tend to happen overnight in the Catholic Church. So my guess is that the movement towards his resignation was something that was being negotiated for weeks, maybe a month or two before our letter got there. Neither do I need to dismiss the letter as insignificant. And I think it probably was one compelling.
Do you know the date of the
letter? That's a good question.
Okay. We could always look it up.
Yeah.
Okay.
December 13th is the date he resigned.
2003.
Right. No, I don't know that. I can find that for
you. Mm-hmm. That's okay. So it was in short proximity.
Yes.
Did he ever respond to the letter in any way?
No.
Okay.
But then again, unfortunately, neither is that typical. In December, I wrote a very strong letter to the Archbishop, Trustees of O'Malley, critical of the way reconfiguration of the Archdiocese was being handled. I quoted some of that letter, my letter to the community, my letter to, but not all of it. And I wrote in the context of a priest who is, I'm happy. I'm in the parish I want to be in, I'm doing the work I want to do, I don't want to do it for myself. I think reconfiguration has been as successful in conquering as it possibly can be. But I wanted him to hear from somebody who's not disgruntled about his own work, that here's what, here's my observations about what's going on in the world. And in that, in the letter I said, your plans appear to be ill-advised. Decisions are indecisive, are variable to the point of your decisions, and your grasp on the damage being done seems to be loose at best. That's fairly strong language for a pastor to write to an ex-bishop. That was December 29th. I've not had a response. So. I'm not holding my breath anymore. Now, I know he gets a lot of critical mail, but it wasn't just an angry letter. I was trying to communicate. So, not to get a response from Cardinal Law, I went to post with that. Of course, no doubt. And that's here. I wouldn't want to paint the whole Catholic Church or even the whole Catholic Church in the United States. The other bishops would be taking that response. But I think in the Archdiocese of London, that's not a time to take that.
During the time that this broke, there emerged the voice of the faithful, and you were welcoming.
The voice of the faithful began as a kind of listening session at St. John's in Wellesley. And the folks there decided to organizing some fashion. So then organizing a group of lay people who wanted a way for their voice to be heard. That's kind of like what the situation is. This happened just as we were having our listening sessions here in the parish in Texas. And two folks from Our Ladies because they had heard what was going on in Wellesley, had gone to some meetings in Wellesley to see what was happening. And it was in the context of our listening sessions that they spoke about this and said maybe we could do something like that here. Well, by that time, the Voice of the Faithful in Wellesley was becoming a pretty well-known group in the Boston area, certainly the Outcasts. But it was not an unknown commodity. So we inquired about forming a local chapter of Voice of the Faithful here. As it turns out, although we didn't know it was going to turn out this way, we were the first chapter of Voice of the Faithful to form after the Wellesley group. And now it's they're worldwide. They're all of them, certainly all of the United States.
And they still meet here.
They do. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it became a controversial group. There are a lot of lay people who said, no, they're not the voice of the faithful because they're not speaking for me. There were pastors who were suspicious of their motives, although their three goals are support of victims of abuse by clergy, support of what they call priests and integrity, and work for structural change in the church. It's that third one that worries some pastors. But they are thoroughly Catholic people. They're not looking to overthrow the Roman Catholic Church. They're looking to make whatever changes need to be made so that we never again find ourselves in a position of looking back significant criminal and moral problem was hidden. In fact, if you look at the membership rolls for Voice of the Faithful, you will find that the average member is in their late 40s or older. They are longtime faithful Catholic practicing. They are involved in their parishes. They're not renegades. They're not rebels. They're the people who otherwise would be the pillars of your church. They're the ones you count on. They're the ones you call first when you need somebody to do something. And they're people who love the church and want to do anything they can to make sure this doesn't happen. Here at Our Ladies, it's the Voice of the Faithful people in Our Lady's parish who took over the whole responsibility that the Archdiocese now requires all parish staff and volunteers to go. It's called Veritas Training, which is a program of training professional and volunteer leadership in church communities to be able to recognize the signs of abuse. So it's kind of a proactive effort by the church to say, if this is going on in the church community, or if we're serving children who are being abused at home, to recognize the signs of abuse. And it's the Voice of the Faithful people in Our Ladies who put that whole program together and ran it for us. It's a great service.
How do you spell that, training?
Virtus, V-I-R-T-U-S, which is the Latin word for religion.
And about how many are they? The local chapter
now calls itself the Concord Area Voice of the Faithful. What happened was, after the group formed at Our Ladies, other parishes in the area were trying to form groups, and they realized that in each parish they had a small group of people, and that it would be better to consolidate. There was no need to bring back a wheel all over the place. So the group continued to meet at Our Lady's, now at Holy Family, but it's inclusive. And I would say that when they're all together, it's about 50 people.
Can they meet weekly?
I think they're meeting, I guess they meet every 2 weeks. Although I am a registered member of Voice of the Faithful, and my name is on the rolls, it is basically a legal organization, so it has my blessing, my endorsement, my support. But they also have to meet on Wednesdays, which is my day off. So that's another reason I'm not there to. And the whole organization, and some local chapters as well, struggle with what their role is and how they can be most effective. Just to back up a little bit, there was, I think it was Cardinal Law, yeah, I'm pretty sure it was Cardinal Law, who issued a ban on the formation of new Voice of the Faithful groups. It was a strange kind of ruling. He said groups that are already in existence may continue to meet under the problem, but new groups cannot form and meet under the problem. I know. just strange stuff. So we had already been formed. There was the date by which, if you already existed, that ban has yet to be lifted. Although Archbishop O'Malley has met, I think maybe 3 or 5 times now, with the Voice of the Faithful leadership from the home office. So that ban is still in effect. So new groups, obviously you can form, but you can't be on church property. So you could meet at the town library, give your room to question, and that's an affront to many Catholic people that I want to be part of an organization whose goals are to support the church, but the church won't let me meet in my own church, which I feel support.
Yes, because for many it's looked at as the new direction of greater lay involvement.
And it is a paradox, huh? Because at least in its official documents, the church is always calling for greater lay involvement.
Mm-hmm.
But any time it gets near positions of authority, any time it gets near criticism of those in authority, then there's a tendency to back off and say, yeah, Father knows best. That's, you know, that may have worked 100 years ago when clergy were the educated class and the average churchgoer was not. Times have changed, incredibly so. And if you got educated people, you know, one of the things that I used to write about was that people of common sense, let alone faith, let alone faith development, let alone education, people of common sense would be afloat and realize that something really wrong happened. And it's not, and it wasn't handled well, but it's not. Faith should always be a reasonable thing. Faith is not irrational. It deals in mysteries, the mystery of God. But it can't be reduced scientifically to data that you can weigh or run through a computer. But true faith always should have a reasonable character about it. And when truly faithful people realize that the stuff they're being given is irrational,
litigation and settlements proved costly. So ultimately, the church was facing a financial crisis as well. And along with churches that may have had diminished population, you were having proposals to close healthy, vibrant churches, and that brings us to the closing of Our Lady. Unexpected.
No, unexpected indeed. one thing that we should note as we approach that topic is this, that certainly there is a connection between the financial settlement abuse cases and what they call reconfiguration, closing boundaries, reconfiguration of enterprises. There is a connection. But if we could suppose for a moment that no priests had ever abused children, that there were no cases, that there were no settlements to be paid, we would still today, the archdiocese would be in a financial crisis. The settlement stuff exacerbates that and hastens it to reality. But the larger reasons for the financial crisis are that over the last 50 years, the Archdiocese has supported, subsidized failing properties, properties failing physically, parishes failing because of demographic shifts. The classic cases are in urban centers where in Dorchester you have 9 parishes and 3 square miles, you know, and there used to be a need for that, because it was a thickly Irish Catholic populated area, which it is not anymore. So you got buildings that are failing, you got buildings that are virtually empty on Sunday because the Catholic population is no longer there, and you don't have priests to staff all those parishes. The Archdiocese has also been subsidizing for years the debt of many parishes. I'm not a fiscal manager, but they tell me that it was fiscally unsound to do that kind of thing. It's just important to note that it's just not the crisis that brought us here. A year ago, this past December, at a meeting of all the priests, the Archbishop announced that they were going to begin a process in January of 2004 for studying parishes to close a significant amount of parishes. The study was done on what's on the cluster level. The Archdiocese is divided into a lot of ways to divide the Archdiocese, but one way is by clusters, which is usually somewhere between 3 and 5 or 6 parishes who are geographically contiguous. The cluster process, which is about 10 years old now, was designed to get parishes to collaborate with resources and personnel. So again, it's not always, it's not a need to have a verse of faith on every parish. If the 5 parishes in the Concord cluster, for instance, all have religious education programs, do we really need 5 directors, full-time aid directors, or could one person coordinate that kind of collaboration was being encouraged? So at the cluster level, the joke was, it was just like the reality shows, what's the thing on the island?
Survivor, yeah.
The clusters were asked to gather and figure out who was going to die, who was going to close, and we were supposed to make a recommendation. Many clusters did that, and you can imagine the ill will that generates among people. Some clusters, like the Concord cluster, refused to recommend anybody. sure that was really what we should have done. because I remember saying at cluster meetings, you know, they're going to close places. And they're just trying to get us involved in the process of a book them. So it might be better for us to really look at this far and long and say, what could close here? But I was a minority voice.
And so you were...
St. Joseph's, well, I don't think it's declining, it's tiny. Well, it was tiny because it is close. Oh, did you? Okay. You know what a little tiny, beautiful, tiny little church that is. So I felt that if something is going to close in the Concord cluster, the obvious candidate is St. Joseph's. But I was outvoted on that, so we did not. We recommended it. No parishes. I was always feeling secure about Our Ladies because, as I said to people over and over again, they won't cut down a healthy tree in the orchard. They're going to prune the orchard, cut down dying trees, trees that aren't producing, trees that don't have good fruits. But they're not going to cut down a healthy tree. Renee, I was convinced to my core of that. But on May 25th, a FedEx truck drove up here and delivered a special delivery letter.
Who else is in the cluster?
The parishes?
To St. Michael's?
Yes, the parishes of the Concord cluster were Our Ladies in St. Bernard's in Concord, St. Michael's in Bedford, St. Irene's in Carlisle, and St. Joseph's in Lexington. So, actually, three of those five were technically closed. St. Joseph's totally closed. Well, St. Joseph's is closed and was absorbed by St. Julius of Weston. However, the Archdiocese is slow to leave any community, any town or city without a Catholic Church. So St. Joseph's Church remains open and there's still Mass there on Sunday. Get married there. They'll still be buried there. It's, I think it's the equivalent of putting somebody on a respirator because you don't want to acknowledge that this person died. And within a couple of years, they're going to have to take St. Joseph's off the respirator because Pastor Weston isn't going to have the priest he needs to continue to serve St. Joseph's. Our Ladies in St. Bernard's were, what's called a double suppression. Both parishes were closed. A new parish was to be formed out of those two closed parishes on the site of one of the two parishes. Our Ladies sat 280 people, and St. Bernard's seats 520. So that was pretty clear which one this building was going to remain open. And it would have been foolish to suppress the two and then try to squeeze the two into Our Ladies.
Your experience, was it 10 years in Our Ladies?
Yes, 10 years, yeah.
And you were part of a very vital parish community.
Yeah. Arguably the most vital community in the five parishes.
It worked.
It did.
A lot of spirit there and...
Spirit was growing. I think it was a model parish. I grieve, I think, almost as much as anyone, because I didn't grow up in this parish. My secretary grew up on Highland Street, right across from the church doors of Our Ladies.
baptized here, she was married here.
Chill.
Chill, yeah. Yep. All her brothers and sisters grew up here. So I don't have that kind of experience. But with everybody, I agree. Closing, I'm related to, as I said a lot of times, it's the spiritual and emotional equivalent of the death.
So you have to deal with a situation that you were, never thought you would face.
Never. Right up there. This is the, we had bought two of these, which we planned to hang for the benefit of the tape recorder. It's a multicolored banner that says open on it. And we bought these because we were so confident that on May 25th, the letter we were going to get was going to say that we were staying open. And we were going to put those up front on the church doors. But we never got to hang them up.
How did people take
it? Oh, it was, it's like a death in the
family. Yeah, yeah.
Emotionally, spiritually, it is a complete parallel to that experience. Grief, confusion, denial, loss, sadness, disorientation, anger, everything that you might experience. Yeah. That's what we experienced here. People talked about, you know, is there something we can do? Now, that's nine months ago now, I guess. So I've got to take us back to 9 months. And there was a process for appealing those decisions. I wrote immediately to the Archbishop to appeal the decision personally as a pastor. And the parish council organized an appeal. And we had almost 1,000 signatures on the letter of appeal. And I told the folks, I obviously we're going to appeal this, but I don't want to get your hopes up because I don't expect that the appeal will be successful. And I'm sorry, it was not successful. So we began the work transitioning to a new parish in Concord over last summer. And it was our closing parishes were given a fair amount of freedom in determining when the close date would be. And in working with the folks from St. Bernard's, we decided that we wanted it to happen before Thanksgiving and Christmas, because we felt that it would be just incredibly difficult to try to go through the holidays knowing that this would be the last Christmas. That somehow it would be better to have that done before then. And I'm glad now that that's exactly what we did. I think that was the wise choice. So we chose October 25th as the closing. For 4 weeks, 4 weeks prior to that, we had, on Sundays, we had special services on Sunday. The first one was a service of lament, ritual prayer for people to come and cry and together. And there was an open mic, people both to cry, to pray, to express their anger, their sadness, their support. It's a whole book of lamentations in the Bible. It's not something. Having been through that experience, I know that we need to provide that at other times for other reasons. People need to come together in their sadness as well as in their joy. Then we had a service of healing that was was, we were very clear that the service of healing wasn't in any way meant to suggest that we can all feel good now. But it was really trying to pray that healing would come. And the third service was an evening prayer service. We have an evening prayer service during the Advent and Lent seasons here. It's a candlelight service on Sunday nights, which has been part of, was part of Our Lady's tradition. So we did that. And then the fourth week, Our Lady's always had a special relationship with us from the community church across the street. We worked together in a lot of ways, very definitely musically, because Jim Barkovic is the director of music for both parishes. So we had an evening service for Our Lady's and was coming to sing and pray for them. And it was so good and so sad and so happy. It was all of those things all in one night. And it was healing. It was an opportunity to beautifully lift up the best of who we are, the best of who we are together, the best part of who we are.
And at that point, you had no idea whether you were going to stay or go.
October 25th, let's see, and of those four Sundays, if I recall correctly, I got the dates right, the first two Sunday services of the four, I didn't know who the pastor was going to be. But I think it was on October 10th that I got the letter saying that I would be the pastor. So somewhere in that, in the month of October, I found out. But it was a very tense time because I had applied for the pastorate in June, right after the parish closings were announced. But we went through the whole, we had a joint transition team made up of about 50 people from the two parishes to engineer the transition to the parish. We were really handicapped all that summer working because we didn't know who the leadership was going to be. So we always had to talk about Pastor X, and we didn't know who Pastor X would be, what he might be like, what he might want to do, what he might not want to do. And it would have been a lot easier if we had known at the beginning of the summer. But we didn't. So the transition work was basically, the planning work for the transition was all done, but not
and what rejoicing.
There was rejoicing. Yes, there was.
And when you left your message, you just sounded so happy.
I was.
And relieved.
And I am. I am.
And we should say that Father Murray retired.
Retired, which is what he wanted to do.
Yeah.
I wanted to be named pastor of the community. He wanted to retire.
And it all made perfect sense.
Oh, it did. Yeah, his desire to retire was a key piece of that because it removed the competition elements. If he had also wanted it. In fact, I think if John Murray had also wanted the pastor or had applied for it, probably neither one of us would have gotten it. It would have been foolish on the part of the archdiocese to pick one in those circumstances.
How was the name decided, the new name?
We, last summer, over about a month's time, in the two parish bulletins, we invited anybody who wanted to submit potential names for the parish. And we got, I think, something like 200 different suggestions. But the three that came out most often were Holy Family, Holy Spirit, spirit of the maybe St. Francis. No, that's not one. Might have been St. Francis. The transition team decided that since the two former parishes had been Our Ladies and St. Bernard's, that we wouldn't choose any variation on Our Ladies. We were Our Lady Help of Christians, but you know, it's Our Lady of Grace and Our Lady of Hope. So we wouldn't do anything that would sort of keep Our Lady's name. And rather than change St. Bernard to, for instance, St. Francis, we wouldn't look at the saint's name. The transition team ended up, we were asked to submit three names to the Archbishop, but we're also told that all other things being equal, whatever your first choice is nothing again. So Holy Family had been the one most suggested in the popular poll, and the people in the transition team were happy with that, so we put that first.
We are in the parish hall next to Our Ladies. We don't know whether this stays.
This building that we're sitting in, I am told that we're keeping this building.
Oh, good.
Yes.
Good.
Now, I've been told a lot of things. currently, the church building is on the market. There are some complications here because the building we're sitting in is on the same parcel of land as the church building. So there are legal realities here that I only understand a little bit about. For instance, if the Archdiocese finds a buyer for the church, we can't simply cut the property line between the two buildings because there are frontage issues and real estate stuff that I don't really understand a lot of. But one possibility is that the Archdiocese sells the church to, say, another church community. And there are other church communities interested in the building. And then it might sell the church building with the proviso that that new church would lease this building to us for $1 a year for 99 years. The Archdiocese has told us that we will be keeping this building.
Wonderful.
It is.
It is
beautiful. But I don't want to say that recognizing there are legal things to be worked out to keep that promise. But I'll tell you, if we lose this building, two things. First of all, there will be upheaval like you have never seen before. And two, I don't know what we'll do because we have almost doubled the size of our staff in the transition process. We've kept most of the staff in both parishes. And that wasn't just to keep people happy. It's because we've doubled the size of our community. We need that kind of staff. The only other building we have is St. Bernard's Rectory in London Square, which is set up as a residence, basically, not as an office building as this is. And the cost of renovating St. Bernard's Rectory is big enough, it's huge. But the cost of renovating St. Bernard's for the kind of use that this building gives us would be out of sight. Just for instance, there's no handicap access to St. Bernard's Rectory. So you'd need to put in an elevated limited service all through the floors. And we don't have that kind of lost a lot of money in terms of reconfiguration process.
When the church is suppressed, whatever monies there are go to the Archdiocese?
For the Archdiocese, and then the Archdiocese gives you startup money. parishes in that process. We're probably losing about $1 million, $1.5 million.
That's tough.
Yes, it is.
The rectory, of course, where you used to live on Main Street, that's being sold.
Well, it's not on the market yet.
Not yet.
No,
okay.
But it will be. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure why it's not on the market yet, but it's not. But it's just empty. I moved out there.
Now, what about the combined parishes and the services, the masses that you now hold? It must be huge.
It is huge, but St. Bernard's Church is big, thank God. One of the nice things is that St. Bernard's Church building really was larger than what St. Bernard's community needed. So now, the folks who used to go to St. Bernard's, or were members of St. Bernard's Parish, have the nice experience of their church being full all the time. Mm-hmm. Always a better experience than mm-hmm. the church being half full. So that's a very wonderful experience. Conversely, people from Our Ladies very much miss their home, their spiritual home, has come. So they're needing, I'm needing to get used to a new space. And if you've been in both of them, they are considerably
Yes, I do.
Our Ladies was a very traditional setup with the sanctuary at one end and pews the rest of the way to the door. And at St. Bernard's, the sanctuary is plopped in the middle of the building with pews on either side. So it's a very different configuration for Catholic worship. Actually, there are people from St. Bernard's who are still trying to get used to that,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
So, but there's, I think the test for me was Christmas. And I know that Christmas was very difficult for many Our Ladies people because it was their first Christmas outside Our Ladies Church. And to go back to my earlier analogy, if you lose someone you love, you know what it's like to go through the first Thanksgiving without your mother, the first Christmas. This is just all pain wells up in me. So, but even with that, and I know that was the experience for other people, we had beautiful Christmas services. Folks standing in the aisles, the music was beautiful, the spirit was good, and people were there. During last summer, a lot of people in West Concord were saying, I'll never go to that other church. But they do. But we've lost some people in the process. And it's a kind of a 1-2 punch, I think. The first punch was the abuse crisis, and that shook a lot of people to their Catholic beliefs. And people left the church at that point, too. But then for some people who were still kind of reeling the abuse crisis, then to have their vibrant parish closed on them, that was just the worst. In a community like Concord, it's difficult to figure out who's left because we're such a mobile community. People are coming and going from week to week. People travel for business, many people have a couple of homes. It's winter time, some people are older people are in Florida for the winter. Younger families have a place in New Hampshire. They're skiing every week. So I haven't, we've been in the process of redoing our database and getting some sense there of actual numbers and who's still with us. But of the combined population of the two former parishes, I don't think we've lost 5%, if that much. So I think that's not too bad. I do anything to get those 5% back. But I think for what we've been through, that's a
good. And I think you're being there, certainly.
Well, it was, I know that my appointment as pastor was an immediate bridge for a lot of West Concord people to make change to the church.
One of the things that always struck me about the West Concord community was the ability to walk to one's church, and that, you know, obviously has gone here. Is parking now an issue as everybody's scrambling around?
Well, in the beginning, people were complaining that it was hard to get a space. They stopped complaining, but they're still coming. So I think what people have done is found out where the spaces are.
Okay.
The lot behind the church is pretty big, but it's not big enough for everybody. And because not only that, but we have, you know, on Sunday mornings, we've got four churches in Concord Center. Now one of them has doubled in size. So parking's at a premium for worshipers anywhere in Concord
right.
Center. But I think people are finding places. When you stop hearing the complaints, you know somehow it got resolved.
But I remember when we talked about your growing parish at Our Lady's, people were coming in from other communities, and of course that must have disrupted.
No, they're still coming.
Oh, they are,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we still have people from Sudbury, Stowe, Acton, Lincoln.
Very much appreciate not only this oral history, but also the letters that you were willing to turn over to your parish. You were so close to your centennial, but you certainly have many years of happy memories to look back on,
absolutely.
And now forming a new parish. Are you able now to stay a full 12 years? Are you?
Yeah, my
beginning?
Clock starts again.
Okay.
Yeah. Now that it's important to remember that the 12-year stint is a combination of 2 6-year terms.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm definitely here for 6 more years. And then at the end of 6, I need to be renewed for another 6. I would certainly ask. The end of my first six-year term at Holy Family, I will be 7 years away from retirement. So.
You're 57?
I'll be 58 in April.
Mm-hmm.
Retirement's at 7.
Mm-hmm.
So I, the possibility of another 6-year term ahead of me at the end of 6 years, with only 1 year beyond. I wouldn't want to move to a new place
no,
in those last
no.
6 years. And I couldn't have seen myself staying at Our Lady's forever. I don't think that would have been healthy for me in the parish. But there's a whole new challenge.
Yeah.
Because some things a priest does, he doesn't know where he is, no matter how long he's been there. But there's a whole new challenge. It's very fresh. So I think about being here another 12 or 13 years.
I look forward to it.
Thanks, Renee.
Thank you.
You're welcome.